It seems our sissy friend is having a little identity crisis. First he was Dustin Reynolds, then he was Goldust, and now he wants to be the King of the Ring. But we all saw you out here with tears running down your face, wondering why your old man, old Dust, don't love you anymore. Well, I know Dusty Rhodes, and he told me why. It's because you married the biggest gold digger in Georgia, then you put on a woman's wig, and you went around the ring kissing men like a flaming fag. But let me tell you something. They're going to all have tears running down their face tonight. Bring that gold digger to the ring and bring that little brat, Dakota, with her.
What?
Because I'm going to tell you this. They're going to all have tears running down their face when I'm through with you. And what'd you name that brat? Dakota? You should have named her Target, because I heard everybody in Atlanta had a shot at it.
All right.
Ouch. There's a reason Jerry Lawler is looked at as one of the greatest promos in the wrestling business now or ever. And that would be one shining example of that. From 1997, Jerry Lawler on his upcoming match on Raw with Goldust. And certainly a controversial promo at the time, and even more so now, given the whole direction of WWE. That's not the sort of thing you're ever going to see again on TV. But boy, did that cause a stir back in 97. And I wanted to play that, actually, last week at the beginning of the podcast, being that Jerry Lawler was kind of on everybody's minds. He was in the TLC match, and everybody was talking about King all week, and it just slipped my mind, but I figured, fuck it, I'll just play it this week. And on that note, this is episode 137 of The Sound Off here on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, December 12th, 2010. I'm the Solemn Monster. Thank you, as always, for downloading the podcast, and got a lot to talk about this week. We're going to talk Raw. We're going to talk Shane Helms. We're going to talk Jeff Hardy. We're going to talk a lot of different things here, and then we'll get to some of your questions at the end. Before I do that, I just want to mention that the latest edition of the SC Scoops mailbag, the official main page mailbag, which I also author, is up. If you have not checked it out already, it was the biggest mailbag yet. I answered about a dozen or so questions, maybe 13 questions, and some good ones in there. So scroll down the main page and find it. Leave some comments in the comments section if you will. And yeah, so I just wanted to mention that first and foremost. Now, before we get to some Raw thoughts and everything else, I suppose I should just talk about this first, the top story, if you will, on the show this week. Since I've been asked about it so much in email and Facebook and all that, what are my thoughts on the Shane Helms comments about our beloved heartbreak kid Shawn Michaels? People figuring, well, you know, Solid Monster is probably going to have a lot to say about what Shane Helms said, and I do, but I just have to preface this by saying Shane Helms, for those of you who do not know, has his own show, basically his own podcast now called Highway to Helms. And it's basically a show where he sits around in his little studio or bedroom or whatever, and he'll have a friend or two with him. He's, you know, I think his first show maybe, I think it was his first show, he did an interview with Matt Hardy talking about his release from WWE. On this particular episode from last week, his co-host was Champagne Marty Garner, who is the one lost soul, if you will, from the old Omega crew, who really never made it big in WWE or WCW or TNA. But he was used often in WWE as a job guy in the mid to late 90s. In fact, he might have been the one, if you have seen the infamous clip on YouTube, that was on the receiving end of a brutal, probably the most brutal pedigree I've ever seen Triple H deliver back in the Hunter Hearst Helmsley days. This would have been back in 95, where he literally pedigreed the guy skull first and just rammed him down into the mat. I'm pretty sure that was Marty Garner in that match. But regardless, Marty Garner is the co-host on this particular episode of Highway to Helms, and he asks Shane Helms, the basic question is, who is the wrestler that I guess you've met? Perhaps you idolized that person, knew of that person, but upon meeting them, you did not have a very favorable impression of that person. And Shane Helms' answer was somewhat surprising in that he answered Shawn Michaels, who once upon a time, it would be difficult for you to find people to say good things about Shawn Michaels. But in more recent times, everybody seems to say nothing but positive things about Shawn Michaels. And, I'm sure he's not a perfect person, but again, big difference from HBK back then to now. So what I'm going to do here, I'm going to play a little clip for you. This is audio taken directly from the Highway to Helm show, which you can check out if you want to. This is a clip of Marty Garner asking the initial question and the initial response from Shane Helms. Take a listen.
Who is your least favorite wrestler of all time after you got to know him?
Probably Shawn Michaels.
Really?
Yeah.
You thought big of him, then he wasn't.
Yeah, Shawn was one of my idols.
Yeah.
And then he really let me down as a person. Shawn let me down in so many ways. I think his whole religious gimmick is a fucking work.
Yeah, I did thought.
I think he's the biggest hypocrite in the business.
Yeah.
And so many people shit on Triple H. I'm telling you, Triple H, that motherfucker always treated me as an equal. Mm-hmm. He was always up front with me. He was always honest with me. I worked with him, and I teamed with Shawn. His ring work, I'm not discounting that. His ring work, that motherfucker is spectacular.
Yeah.
His matches with The Undertaker and WrestleMania, that's some of the greatest matches that will ever go down, ever, 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 fucking ever.
Right.
But him as a person, that whole religious shit, I think it's some fucking work.
Yeah.
I think he's a hypocrite. I think he's the biggest hypocrite in this fucking business.
A farce.
I don't think it's a farce. I think he believes part of it. But at the same time, you gotta live that life.
Yeah.
If you're gonna preach it, you gotta fucking live it.
Yeah.
And he's all the time tweeting about hunting. I'm like, dude, you're fucking rich. Why are you murdering fucking animals?
Yeah.
Dude, you're fucking rich. You got fucking millions of dollars. You're out there murdering animals because it makes you fucking happy?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Jesus would do that. I read the Bible and I saw Jesus with a fucking rifle on his shoulder. Fuck you.
So there you go. Some pretty strong comments from the former Hurricane Helms. Obviously talking about the fact that he idolized Shawn Michaels growing up, which, I mean, you can find a million people that would tell you the same thing. And you can even see many wrestlers who pattern themselves in the ring after HBK. But not really all that enthusiastic about the kind of person that Shawn Michaels is today. Calling him the biggest hypocrite in the business. His whole religious gimmick, as he calls it, is a work. He thinks that Shawn Michaels is basically full of shit. He's still very immature. Now, what you heard in that clip, let me address that first. I don't have a problem with much of what he said in that particular clip, which is not to say that I agree with what Shane Helms is saying, but understand that he has a podcast just like I have a podcast. And Lord knows I've, you know, ripped on people before. There's people I don't like. You know, in this case, Shane Helms has met Shawn Michaels, has worked with Shawn Michaels, and so he has a better interpretation of these things than I do. I don't claim to know Shawn Michaels or anybody else. Who's to say that Shawn Michaels wasn't being an asshole backstage? You know, you didn't hear it in that clip, but basically it sounds like the animosity here stems from an incident, an alleged incident that took place behind the scenes. Probably would have been, I guess, in 08 or 09. Regardless, as Shane Helms explains it, it was an incident in catering one afternoon where I guess Shawn Michaels was either yelling at or in some way being disrespectful to Chris Jericho. And Shane Helms saw this and was very upset by this and nearly confronted Shawn Michaels on the spot. I guess whatever he saw or whatever he heard, he was turned off by it. And his view of Shawn Michaels apparently was transformed by this incident. Now, did this incident take place? Who the fuck knows? I wasn't there. I guess we just have to take his word for it. He was in the locker room and we weren't. Chris Jericho has never said word one about this. None of the wrestling news sites said anything. You know, sometimes wrestlers will leak stories to them about shit that happens backstage. I don't remember hearing word number one about any incident between Shawn Michaels and Chris Jericho. The two of them work together a lot. By all accounts, they're pretty good friends. They get along with each other. It could have just been Shawn Michaels having a bad day. Who knows? I seem to think that it goes a little beyond that. You know, if Shane Helms wants people to believe that this one incident that he supposedly witnessed changed his entire view of Shawn Michaels and he hates his guts now because of it, I call shenanigans on that. Here's what I take away from what I heard him say there. And again, he's entitled to his opinion. It's his own podcast. I can't criticize him for it. He can say whatever he wants. But it sounds to me like Shane Helms does not like people who hunt for sport. Just listening to his comments, he is very much upset about the fact that Shawn Michaels claims to be a great religious Christian individual who just so happens to kill animals for fun. My opinion of that is irrelevant, whether I happen to agree with him or not. But what I do have a problem with is when he launches into the personal, juvenile attacks on another man's character because he thinks that his religious beliefs are bullshit. Who's to say whether Shawn Michaels is some great born-again Christian or not? If you were to ask me my personal opinion, he seems like a changed man. I mean, what purpose would it serve to pretend that he's some great Christian? You know, there's certain wrestlers, Ted DiBiase being one of them, and again, even in his case, I don't doubt that, you know, DiBiase takes his faith very seriously, and he's a changed man from his old ways, but, you know, he runs his own ministry. You know, certain people, you know, run their own ministries, they make a business out of it, they go around doing speeches and stuff like that. By all accounts, Shawn Michaels does none of that. He does not try to make money off of this. He does not go around speaking all the time at different churches and different establishments, runs his own ministry or his own events. By and large, when it comes to his religion, it seems like he keeps to himself. The only thing I ever heard as far as while he was in WWE is that one of the reasons, if not the primary reason, he never was moved over to the SmackDown brand was because he has a Bible study class on Wednesdays. And since SmackDown tapes on Tuesdays, that posed a scheduling conflict for him. When Shane Helms later on in that same show goes on to call Shawn Michaels a cockeyed, cross-eyed piece of shit, more importantly, when he goes on to make the remark that Shawn was one of the biggest drug users in the history of the business who snorted more coke and did more steroids than anybody else in wrestling. That's where I take umbrage right there. First of all, if Shane Helms honestly believes that Shawn Michaels did more steroids than anybody in the history of wrestling, then Shane Helms is fucking dumber than he sounds. That's a pretty goddamn ridiculous statement to make right there. Does Shawn Michaels have a history with drugs? Has he snorted coke? I'm sure he has. You know, his own drug problems and whatnot are well documented. But again, I have not heard word one about any of this, probably since Shawn's first run with the company. By and large, he's been an upstanding citizen, a fine employee. Lord knows he would go out there and have the best match on virtually every show. People who worked with him didn't seem to have a problem with him. He'll go into the Hall of Fame within the next couple of years, and he'll be revered by most, reviled by few. I really think that, you know, the Shawn Michaels of the 1990s is almost a completely different person from the Shawn Michaels of the 2000s. And Shane Helms is perfectly entitled to make comments about Shawn Michaels if he thinks that he is, hiding some sort of, you know, quality. Again, maybe he behaves in a different way backstage than most people would figure. Or if Shane Helms has a problem with the fact that Shawn Michaels hunts for sport when he feels as a religious individual he shouldn't be doing that sort of thing. He is entitled to those opinions. But when you come out and you say, oh, this guy's the biggest drug user in the history of the business, and he snorted more coke, and he did more steroids, and he's a cockeyed piece of shit, you lose much of your credibility in my book. In that respect, I think Shane Helms needs to keep his fucking mouth shut. He's entitled to his opinion, but he took it a little too far there. And furthermore, if Shane Helms wants to go off on somebody for being a drug user, I mean, that's in a way like calling, you know, the pot calling the kettle black here. If you really want to open up that can of worms, let's do that. First and foremost, need I say more about the fact that two of Shane's very best friends in the business and in life happen to be Matt and Jeff Hardy. The same Jeff Hardy who is facing drug charges in North Carolina. The same Jeff Hardy, and Matt Hardy for that matter, who were filmed in a diner looking as cracked out as a crack addict can possibly be. And for those of you who say, oh, they were working in that video where Jeff Hardy ripped on CM Punk, it was all an act, and, you know, bullshit. Bullshit. They were pretty fucked up in that video. And I'm willing to bet they're fucked up a hell of a lot more than just in that one video. And these are the people that Shane Helms associates himself with. I'm sure Shane Helms, though, is a perfectly upstanding citizen who does not partake in any of that stuff that his friends do. Oh, I'm positive of that. And let us not forget this little tidbit as well. March 2007, Sports Illustrated posts an article on its website. It's part of an investigation into steroid and HGH use, this steroid and HGH ring that's being used by professional athletes across the sports world, including pro wrestlers. And the article mentions that several WWE wrestlers, both past and present, including Shane Helms, are alleged to have obtained HGH. WWE even had to make a statement on the whole situation and post it on its website. Another Sports Illustrated article, that same year, named Shane Helms again and 9 other wrestlers who were given growth hormone not in compliance with the talent wellness program. And allegedly, he was said to have received testosterone, HGH, and nandrolone between November 2003 and February 2007. So if Shane Helms wants to open up a can of worms like that, let's just do that. But you really need to watch your words before you speak, because you're going to look pretty fucking stupid at the end of the day. Shane Helms is not one to be talking about drug use and people doing stupid fucking things. So that's my comments on the situation. Speaking of Jeff Hardy, I suppose that we should just get into that little story here. A couple of different tidbits on Jeff Hardy. Let's go back to last weekend. TNA had its Final Resolution pay-per-view, which by all accounts was not a very good show. Or it had a very good first half and then it kind of fell off a cliff. That seems to be the consensus. There was some good matches on that show, but it just completely bombed at the very end. The main event sucked. I actually did see part of the main event. It pretty much blew chunks. But there was some drama before the show involving Jeff Hardy in that supposedly TNA officials came very close to keeping Jeff Hardy off the show, out of the main event, and stripping him of the TNA World Championship due to him being in, quote-unquote, no condition to perform. Now, with Jeff Hardy, we've heard this story before. I think people let their imaginations run a little wild. As it turned out, supposedly, this was all blown out of proportion. Jeff Hardy had gone overseas to Abu Dhabi to perform. That's a 20-hour flight. He was exhausted. He came back. He did some promotional work. He only had one day at home. He has a new baby. There's no evidence to contradict anything. So we chalk it up to Jeff Hardy simply being tired. But I still think that somebody with Jeff Hardy's past, and again, there is no real wellness policy in TNA. They have their own drug policy, which by and large is a farce. I don't think anybody has ever been penalized in any way, whether they failed a test or not. And again, you watch a video like that YouTube video of Jeff Hardy in a diner at God knows what time of night, looking all cracked out, talking about CM Punk. And when you put shit like that out there on the internet, people are going to think things about you. And if you don't want people to think things about you, then don't put fucking stupid shit like that on YouTube. That was the situation at Final Resolution. Jeff Hardy did wrestle. He had a shitty match. But it seems like it was all blown out of proportion. Now, what's not blown out of proportion, and is very much real, is the situation that Jeff Hardy still faces with respect to the drug charges that are facing him. He appeared in a courtroom this past week in North Carolina to defend himself against these charges. Again, he was originally arrested in September of 2009. It's been well over a year now. He has gotten numerous continuances in court to the point where I don't think that he's ever going to face these charges. They just keep delaying and delaying and delaying and delaying things. There was a press release put out by the Moore County Sheriff's Office, and I found this interesting. I didn't remember exactly what the charges stem from in terms of the different kinds of pills and how many pills. So again, just to reiterate here for those of you who may have forgotten, what they found in Jeff Hardy's home last year were 262 Vicodin prescription pills, 180 Soma prescription pills, 555 milliliters of anabolic steroids, a residual amount of powder cocaine, and various items of drug paraphernalia when doing a search of his home. Specific charges against Hardy include conspiracy to traffic in opium, which is that's probably the most serious charge. Trafficking in opium by possession, 2 counts of possession with intent to distribute, felony possession of cocaine, felony maintaining a controlled substance in a vehicle or dwelling, and misdemeanor possession of drug paraphernalia. So that's some pretty serious shit that Jeff Hardy is facing. And again, he got another continuance. I don't think he's due back in court until the end of January now. So I don't know what this means, the constant continuances. Perhaps if there's somebody with a legal background, they can shed some more light on this. I don't know if this favors Jeff Hardy, or if this, favors the prosecution. But, you know, I am of the opinion, let's just get this shit over with here. Because if Jeff Hardy is not guilty of these charges, then, you know, justice is not being served here by keeping this guy hanging in limbo for so long. And, of course, if Jeff Hardy is guilty of some or all of these charges, then he needs to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. to set an example here that you can't do stupid shit like this. So that's the drug update on Jeff Hardy, who is still the TNA champion coming out of the pay-per-view and will apparently not be defending the title on the January TNA pay-per-view show, but will in February. Apparently the main event of the TNA pay-per-view in January will be a number one contenders match, I believe between Mr. Anderson and Matt Morgan, but I'm not 100% sure about that. And the winner will face Jeff Hardy in February. Of course, TNA has had a lot of Impact tapings. They might have had four or five different tapings this past week. All their TV now is taped through the beginning of January. They have no shows, no house shows even, I think, until the beginning of January. They are done. All of their stuff is in the can, so they better hope that nobody gets hurt between now and then, which they shouldn't, considering that they have no shows, but TNA does have some of its guys wrestling on the independents, so yeah, their TV is booked through the new year. Raw this past Monday night, not a very good show. I think most people who were posting on my Facebook and Twitter were of the same opinion. There was at least one guy who apparently thought Raw was a 10 out of 10, so not quite sure what math he's using to come to that formula, but hey, to each their own. If he enjoyed the show, more power to him. I thought Raw sucked pretty much on Monday night. You can't win them all. There's been some good shows recently. This was not one of them. But that does not mean that there were not some enjoyable moments, in large part due to the beauty on commentary of one CM Punk, who seems to be coming into his own, which is kind of a shame, actually, because you just know that by the time Punk gets really, really good and finds his groove, it'll be time for him to come back and wrestle. So that sucks. But for now, we get to enjoy him on commentary, and he had some gems on Monday night, including one line in particular, which I thought was just friggin' hilarious, where John Cena, who of course is fired, and we'll get to him in a second, but John Cena made an appearance at ringside. Came from out of nowhere, and CM Punk was taken aback by this, didn't know what the hell was going on, and made a comment that he saw a huge purple thing come from under the ring, and he thought it was Grimace. I thought that was funny. John Cena. Let's talk about this storyline here a little bit. Now, obviously, we all know it's bullshit. You know, they couldn't even go 1 week and let the stipulation from Survivor Series sink in. Keep him off TV for 1 week. They couldn't even do that. You know, the very next night he made that impassioned speech, which was actually pretty damn good. And he was right back on TV the following week. The whole Juan Cena gimmick apparently has only been used on house shows. It's not a TV gimmick. You know, they just were afraid to keep John Cena off TV. You know, he's their golden goose. It's the holiday season. They want to sell more Never Give Up C-Nation merchandise. And they don't want their ratings to fall, you know, as though their ratings are booming with John Cena on TV. And that's what happens. And my whole thing is, if that's what you're so worried about, then why make that the stipulation for your Survivor Series pay-per-view main event in the first place if you knew you never were even going to go 1 week without the man on TV? So what makes this even funnier is technically Cena is still fired, and yet he's been making appearances, he's been hopping the guardrail, and again, I know that little excuse that he said a couple of weeks ago where security didn't like Nexus. That's fucking horse shit. There's different security in every single building. People need to do their jobs. I mean, if you're trying to make this as a believable storyline, you cannot convince me that John Cena can just go from one building to the other week after week, and can come and go as he pleases without being tackled and tased by security, which I think would be kind of funny, actually, if security took a taser to John Cena one of these weeks. That would make this whole storyline worth it, in fact. But that did not happen, and this past week was even dumber. They took this storyline to a new level of dumb. Wade Barrett was supposedly hiding out in a hotel room nearby and was going to give an interview, and instead it was David Otunga, the worst actor in World Wrestling Entertainment, with John Morrison not too far behind. And Otunga is talking about how, you know, whatever. He's talking about Cena. There's a knock at the door. It's room service. Of course, we're all led to believe that it's Cena, who does, in fact, knock on the door next, comes in, beats up Otunga. Husky Harris comes out from the shadows, I guess. They had a trap set for Cena, but of course, Cena is smarter than all of Nexus combined. So he beats up Husky Harris. Otunga runs away, and somehow Cena manages to get to the building pretty quickly. I think in the next segment, in fact, or two segments later, there he is in the building. So that hotel must have been really close by, which I guess is possible. Those of you in New York, you know that the Nassau Coliseum has a Marriott hotel literally right next door, so I suppose it's possible. Not very believable, though, but yet Cena comes out, and there was a four-way tag match where he basically cost Justin Gabriel and Heath Slater the unified tag team pennies. Cena not making Nexus's life very easy these days. And by the end of the show, Wade Barrett comes out. He calls out John Cena. They're both in the ring. Yes, the fired John Cena is in the ring for a promo with Wade Barrett. And Cena's talking about the fact that he actually kind of likes being fired. It's something he can get used to. This is great. He doesn't seem to care anymore about the championship. He doesn't seem to care about going to WrestleMania. Cena seems to be perfectly fine with being fired and just showing up every week and doing whatever the hell it is that he wants to do. And Wade Barrett, who last week and the week before and even earlier in this very show was on the record as saying, "I will never, ever reinstate you into WWE." All of a sudden, in the middle of this promo, he starts talking about how, well, let's just say, for example, if I were to reinstate you. So, again, stupid. Stupid, stupid, stupid. And Cena basically tells him, well, I might stop attacking the rest of Nexus, but I will never stop attacking you. And by the end of the show, Nexus had staged a mutiny. As Wade Barrett told them to attack Cena, they refused. They turned their back and walked away. Wade Barrett confronted them backstage, and Otunga basically told them that the rest of Nexus has decided that if next week on the 3-hour Slammy Award edition of Raw, if you don't rehire John Cena, as though Wade Barrett is apparently a corporate executive in the company and has the power to do this, if you don't rehire Cena or reinstate Cena, whatever, then Wade Barrett himself will be out of Nexus. Now, if I'm Wade Barrett and I have these four or five other fucking idiots who don't listen to what I... They absolutely do not listen to anything that I say. They lose most of their matches. They look like a bunch of fucking idiots. They get beat up by one guy all the time. Apparently, they get distracted very easily, too. Why the hell would I want to keep associating myself with these guys? If I'm Wade Barrett, I say, sayonara. I'm going to branch out on my own here. You guys can go do whatever you want. So I would assume that next week, John Cena is going to be reinstated. I don't know if the inevitable match between him and Barrett will be on the TLC pay-per-view. I think that would be pretty dumb to put that match on pay-per-view with... well, it just seems like it's... I know the storyline's been going on for a while, but it just seems like you would want to drag it out a little bit more and promote that match for the Royal Rumble, perhaps. But and maybe they will. But this whole storyline, which started in a very promising fashion and was very intriguing, because they could have gone in a number of directions. And, of course, they chose the path of least resistance. Again, the outcome to that main event at Survivor Series could not have been more predictable and by the book. And sometimes by the book works. We don't always need shocking swerves for storylines to make sense. But in this case, it's just fucking boring. It doesn't really make much sense. And we all knew the eventual outcome to this would be essentially the disintegration of Nexus. Apparently they have booking plans mapped out for Nexus, as well as Cena and Miz and Orton and all those guys, through February. I don't know what those booking plans are, but supposedly they have plans through February, so perhaps Nexus is going to stick around a few more months, but I think their days together are numbered. Now, I made this comment on Twitter after Raw Monday night that if I were Wade Barrett, to be a real prick, I would not rehire John Cena, and I would make him sit on the sidelines, and the day after WrestleMania in the Georgia Dome next year, I would rehire him. Just so he can miss the big show. See, if I were Wade Barrett, that's what a true heel would do. Anyway, Sheamus came out wearing the most ridiculous costume since Triple H at WrestleMania 22. He apparently kidnapped the Barbarian or broke into his house and stole his antlers and attached them to a crown. And that is what he wore on his head Monday night, with a robe, coming to the ring, and you know, the thing is, Sheamus is an ass kicker. He's a main event guy. He's gotten over tremendously. I like Sheamus. You know, he's one of the top stars on the Raw brand, former world champion on two separate occasions. And when he walked out like that, I just shook my head. Sheamus is not a guy that you want to turn into a comedy figure. You know, which is what I was a little worried about when he was working with Santino Marella, although that was just for a couple of weeks. But Sheamus should not be walking out to the ring looking like that. And he looked pretty stupid. John Morrison came out and made an even dumber comment. You know, Morrison said that He beat Sheamus at Survivor Series, which he did. And then Sheamus beat him last week in the King of the Ring finals, so they're tied 1-1. And therefore, Morrison said, that means I am the better man. Someone must have been absent from math class. I mean, I guess I get what he was trying to mean in that they're tied 1-1 and Morrison knows he's the better man, but it didn't come out that way. It sounded really stupid. And obviously this is all leading to Triple H's eventual comeback. The King of the Ring against the King of Kings. Apparently Triple H not going to be back until 2011. But should be back in time to promote a match, I would assume, between him and Sheamus for the Royal Rumble in January. So that's the current timeline on the potential return for Triple H. He will be back very soon, but it will not be this month. He did make an appearance at the Tribute to the Troops taping, which I think that show's going to air next weekend, I believe, on NBC. I don't know that that's going to make the airwaves. The end of the main event, which might have actually been a dark match, John Cena wrestled, which, again, it's a show for the troops, so I'm not going to get upset about that, but again, just stupid. But apparently after the match, Triple H and Shawn Michaels came out for a little DX reunion to celebrate with the troops at the end of the show. I do not think that will be airing on TV, but I guess we'll have to wait and see. You know, rumor has it that if you say Triple H's name three times, he appears and gives you a pedigree, kind of like Beetlejuice. Anyway, the only other thing from Raw really of note is that Tyson Kidd has a new bodyguard. It is the former Jackson Andrews, this big, tall, jacked-up dude from Florida Championship Wrestling. I don't know what his name is going to be on TV. They have not yet given him a name. And obviously, they're trying to recreate the Shawn Michaels and Diesel dynamic. In fact, Diesel didn't have a name either on TV for a few weeks until the King of the Ring in 93 when Shawn Michaels was doing a promo backstage and he told the world that the bodyguard's name was Diesel. So I assume maybe next week, or rather this Monday perhaps, we'll find out what this guy's name is. But Tyson Kidd and David Hart Smith, who CM Punk, God bless him, but he kept calling him D.H. Smith on commentary, so he's a little dated there in his reference. They apparently had a spectacular 10 to 12 minute match on Superstars, I think the week before last. And that is what earned them a slot on this show. That match was so good that people backstage said, we got to put these guys on Raw. And of course, they went out there on Monday night and they had what? Maybe 2-3 minutes? It was not a great match. Tyson Kidd won. And he won, you know, pretty much on his own. His bodyguard didn't interfere. It wasn't until after the match that the big dude beat up Harry Smith. I was thinking once he threw him in the ring, he was going to give him a power bomb like Kevin Nash, but unfortunately he did not. And I think he should. You know, the power bomb, even though I know we saw Randy Orton power bomb Alex Riley through a table, but that probably is going to be the only time we ever see Randy Orton do that move. We don't really have anybody in the company that utilizes the power bomb as their move. And if they're going to go all the way with this guy as a Kevin Nash clone, you may as well give him the power bomb. I mean, just the way he moves, his mannerisms, stepping over the top rope, it's so obvious that he is either trying to be or was told to mimic Kevin Nash. And you know, when I think of telling wrestlers to mimic other wrestlers, I don't know that Kevin Nash would be at the top of my list of guys that I would want to mimic, but to each their own, I suppose. You know, I hope it works out. I don't have a lot of faith. This is the exact same thing that they did with Brian Kendrick and Ezekiel Jackson on SmackDown a few years ago. You know, here's Kendrick, the small guy, being seconded by this big guy as his bodyguard, and it didn't last very long. And that was exactly what they had in mind for Kendrick as well. They were going for the Shawn Diesel dynamic, because that was the first time the company did something like that, and it worked. It was with Shawn Michaels and Diesel. And Diesel even became a main event player out of it. But they don't give these things, they don't give these acts time to work. They have the, you know, the patience of a child with ADD. So, of course, that got cut off at the legs, and eventually Zeke got moved over to Raw. So is it going to work out with Tyson Kidd and this big guy? My gut tells me probably not. I cannot see the company pushing Tyson Kidd beyond a certain level. However, if anybody gets over, it's going to be the big guy. That's the guy I think that perhaps they see money in. They don't see any money in Tyson Kidd. Tyson Kidd is actually the bit player here. It's just a matter of how big, or rather how good or bad, I should say, this guy is. If this guy is Great Khali bad, well, then there's only so much they can do with him. But if he's got some talent, you know, maybe he's witty, perhaps on promos like Kevin Nash's, or maybe he's you know, green, but he's okay in the ring and can improve, then this guy might have a pretty good future ahead of him. So we'll see. Very sad to see that Paul Bearer apparently met his doom again, this time on SmackDown this week. Of course, this idiotic storyline involving Edge and Kane, and I know some of you actually like this bullshit, this has just been absolutely fucking atrocious television. And it doesn't make any sense either, because Edge comes off as such a sadistic bastard, and Edge is much better as a heel. But the problem is that Edge is not supposed to be the heel. Edge is supposed to be the babyface. And Kane, who has been doing, you know, destructive things, he buried The Undertaker, you know, on pay-per-view, and has been cutting these evil promos now for months, is coming off as a guy that you almost feel sorry for. He just wants his dad back. And every week, Kane would think that he got Paul Bearer back, and it turned out to be a decoy or a dummy. And this time, it was actually Paul Bearer, and Kane didn't believe it, and he pushed him over, and Paul Bearer fell from a great height into a pit, and presumably died, just like he presumably met his fate years ago in the concrete crypt at the Great American Bash. I'm sad about this because I really like Paul Bearer being back, and if there was one redeeming quality about this storyline, it was Paul Bearer, quite frankly. I mean, his facials and just, he's a great character. And again, he worked, I should say, a lot better. That whole character worked better 15 years ago, 20 years ago. It's a little hokey now, but I like Paul Bearer being around. And if this was his true send-off, and I'm not 100% sure that it was, but if it was, that sucks. And there's absolutely nothing left redeeming to the storyline. Perhaps Paul Bearer will be kept off TV a couple of months. And being that Kane, even though he didn't mean to, being that Kane was the one that pushed him over, perhaps if Undertaker can make it back in time for WrestleMania, and they go for a Kane-Undertaker match, maybe Paul Bearer can once again reunite with The Undertaker, walk out with him at WrestleMania, and Undertaker, I'm sure, can just beat Kane for the third time. So I don't know if that's the direction they're going in. And from all accounts, Undertaker's shoulder is messed up to the point that it could be career-threatening. He had surgery on a rotator cuff tear in his shoulder, and apparently when they went in a couple of weeks ago, it was a lot worse than expected. And even before they knew that, he was touch and go as far as whether or not he would make WrestleMania. So I don't even know that Undertaker will be able to wrestle at WrestleMania, or maybe in some sort of tag match. But not looking too good right now. And if he does make it, it just seems like Kane would be the most logical opponent. You know, he's not going to be back on TV and able to do much long enough to come up with a new feud. And Kane is the last person that he was feuding with. Kane is the one who buried him and put him out of action. And Kane may be the safest and easiest opponent for him to work with. So I actually have just stopped thinking about potential opponents for The Undertaker at WrestleMania because I just think it's a lost cause for 2011. So we'll see. We'll see if he can make it back in time. But this Edge-Kane crap on SmackDown sucks. And it sucks that Paul Bearer seemingly is gone, at least for the time being, because he was the only enjoyable and comical thing about this whole thing. He actually wrote on Twitter, "What an abrupt end to a fun, unexpected ride. Will I ever return? Never say never." So, God bless Paul Bearer. Hopefully we'll see him back soon enough. Speaking of shoulder injuries, Goldust had surgery this past Friday on his shoulder. He might have also had a rotator cuff injury. Apparently he's going to be out up to 6 months, so that sucks. He's got an autobiography coming out, I think this month, actually. And he has been on a tear. You know, he's in the best shape of his career. He's had some pretty great matches. He just had that storyline where he had the $1 million belt, and he was feuding with DiBiase and the whole wedding on NXT with Oksana. And apparently the reason they dropped that whole storyline with him and Oksana and DiBiase is because he suffered that injury, and they knew that he might need some time off. So hopefully, you know, he'll recover quickly, and they won't cut him or anything like that. I know they've done that in the past with certain people, where when they're hurt, and if you're not a mid to, you know, mid card to main event player, when they have those rounds of cuts every now and then, they've gotten rid of people before. I think Goldust, though, you know, is one of these veterans that even if he comes back and they don't really do much with him, he's the kind of guy I see in the near future retiring, or even if he doesn't officially retire, being moved into that spot as an agent or maybe a trainer down in Florida. He has done nothing but kick ass since WWE brought him back. He's kept himself in shape. He's been a great presence, apparently, backstage. He's had some pretty great matches on TV. In some ways, he's even better than he was during his initial run as Goldust, even though the character was a lot more controversial and whatnot back then. So hopefully Goldust will get over this and he'll still have a job when all is said and done. Now, I caught a show this past week that I'm sure some of you saw or at least heard about. It was actually a new show that Bob Saget hosts on the A&E Network called Strange Days with Bob Saget. And this particular episode was a wrestling-themed episode where Bob... And the basic premise here is that Bob will follow around certain people and will do certain activities to learn about a particular industry or a particular city or whatever the case may be, to learn a little bit more about whatever it is that the subject is, and in this case, it was pro wrestling. So, at the beginning of the episode, Bob goes to an independent, not an independent, but a backyard wrestling show, and they show people having matches in a real ring. It was a professional, ring, at least, thank God, and not a fucking trampoline. And he's watching this, and from there, he moves on to some Lucha Libre, and an independent show where I think it was Los Chivos, I believe, was the tag team that was wrestling and that he was talking to. And there was one funny part where Bob is, he's narrating the episode as well as hosting it, and he says, Los Chivos, which translates to the Chivos, which I thought was kind of funny. In reality, I looked it up, it actually means goats. It actually means the goats, which is actually a pretty shitty tag team name. But regardless, he is welcomed into their home, he gets to meet their family, he gets to see how they're behaving, and he learns that, these guys, obviously they're not normal, they're walking around in masks for crying out loud. They make their young kids wear masks in the house, at least for the TV cameras. And, it's a nice thing that, they show them kissing their family before they leave for the big show, and he's at the show, and they have footage of their match, and they come back, and they're all bloodied backstage, but they're really happy, and they have the belts, and at the end of the episode, Bob actually moves on to a more professional show, a Dragon Gate USA show. Of course, Dragon Gate USA is the promotion that is run and booked by Gabe Sapolsky, the former head booker for Ring of Honor, and Paul Heyman's understudy in the original ECW, and Gabe even has a quick cameo on camera during the episode. In this particular scene, he's backstage with the boys and introduces Rowdy Roddy Piper, who Gabe had invited to give a pep talk, a speech, backstage. And this entire thing, or at least the edited version of Piper's speech, appears on TV, and not as good as the promo he cut on Raw during Piper's Pit a couple of weeks ago, but still, a great Roddy Piper promo. And Bob Saget seems to be enthralled by it, and he even at one point talks to Roddy one-on-one and seems to gain a newfound respect for pro wrestling after talking to Roddy Piper and seeing these guys go out there and just balls to the wall and put it all on the line. It was kind of funny when Bob came out as the guest ring announcer. He did that on the independent show in what was mostly a Spanish audience, and he tried speaking Spanish, and his Spanish was not very good, and that was kind of funny. On this show, he comes out to do the ring announcing, and it's great because there's one guy in the crowd who heckles him and says, "Full House sucks," to which Bob replies, "Not as much as your mom," and the crowd goes crazy. They popped huge. I thought that was great. Bob Saget, he's a comedian. I mean, those of you who don't know him, which is probably only a few of you, but those of you who don't know him, he is best known for being on a sitcom here in the U.S. back in the 90s called Full House. And very tame, family-oriented show. It was on the air for many years. And then he went on to host a show called America's Funniest Home Videos. But in reality, Bob Saget has a very a very dirty personality. He's a comedian. He's a stand-up comedian. His act is actually far from family-oriented. Far, 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 far from family-oriented. But that's what's so great about the guy. So again, in this episode, especially at the beginning, you get the impression, not that he's being necessarily disrespectful towards wrestling and the wrestlers, but he's cracking jokes. He's being very sarcastic. He may not be taking it all that seriously. But by the end of the episode, he, again, has come to have a newfound respect and appreciation for professional wrestling. He speaks very glowingly about it at the end and how they're hardworking guys supporting their families and living their dream. And you're not left at all with a bad taste in your mouth at the end of the episode. It was actually a pretty damn good show. And if you did not see it, they might still be replaying it on A&E, but they have the full episode, I think, online right now that you can stream at the A&E website, which I think is, I don't know the full URL. If you just go to Google and type in A&E, the network website will come right up and you can search for it there. If you haven't seen it, it's only half an hour long. If you watch it online without commercials, it's probably less. I'd say it's definitely worth taking 20 minutes of your time and checking out. The other thing I wanted to mention here before I get to the mailbag is I don't know if it's still on. It should still be on WWE Classics On Demand for those of you who subscribe, or it may have disappeared at you know, when they recycled content, or rather refreshed content for the week. But they had a two-part house show up in the Big Ones section on 24/7, and it was a house show from Madison Square Garden from December 28th, 1984. Now, when I first saw that, I usually skip over the house shows. I just don't have time to watch them. And they'll put house shows on there from the Garden and from the old Boston Garden and from, you know, Chicago and L.A. and the old Maple Leaf Gardens in Toronto. But this particular MSG house show, which probably actually did air on TV at that time on the MSG network, is actually quite significant. And I didn't realize it until I read a review of the show online, and then I went and I watched. And this show is important because it has an angle on it. First of all, it's one of the all-time great wrestling angles. And the significance of this angle is that it was essentially this angle on this particular show that kicked off the build to the Hulk Hogan-Roddy Piper feud, which led to the main event of WrestleMania. This was the WrestleMania kickoff angle that was going to make or break the World Wrestling Federation and led to the Hogan-Piper feud. And what happened was, then WWF president Jack Tunney, who was also a, he was actually a wrestling promoter himself up in Canada, but of course he was the figurehead president for many, many years on WWF TV when actually being an authority figure meant something, not this stupid GM bullshit that they have these days. Jack Tunney came out with the house mic, which they used to lower from the ceiling in the Garden. And he was here to essentially MC a very special ceremony. And he actually brought out Dick Clark, who I had never realized Dick Clark had anything to do with this angle. I never knew that Dick Clark ever set foot inside a WWF ring. But there he was, being invited into the ring by Jack Tunney, who also invited out the then women's champion Wendi Richter and the World Wrestling Federation champion Hulk Hogan. They both came out with a trophy, with an award, that they were going to present to one Cyndi Lauper, who, of course, was one of the, if not the most popular and successful female music artist at the time in this country. Girls just want to have fun. And here comes Cyndi Lauper, and with her manager, David Wolf, they come out, and everyone says great things about Wendi and what she's done in her career. This is when they were doing the whole rock and wrestling thing, bringing the two worlds together at the time. And they also brought out Captain Lou Albano, which I'll get to that. Actually, Wendi brought him out. I'll get to that in a second. Cyndi. Cyndi Lauper has some words to say on the microphone, and she invites Captain Lou Albano out. And Lou, this might have been the first time he came out as a babyface in the Garden, because people were still booing him. If this wasn't his first babyface appearance, then he was still relatively fresh as a babyface. I mean, he was a heel for years. People in the Garden hated him. Here comes Lou, and the reason that she invited Lou out, they were very good friends. Cyndi actually had Lou in one of her all-time classic music videos, the music video for the song Girls Just Want to Have Fun. She, you know, Lou Albano played her father in the video. But apparently they were bringing him out to honor his work on behalf of multiple sclerosis and millions of dollars that they helped raise for that insidious disease. After a few minutes of Captain Lou talking and thanking everybody, here comes Ace, Cowboy Bob Orton, and Rowdy Roddy Piper, who had just participated in a tag team match earlier in the night. They came back out. Piper gets in the ring. is not happy about what's going on. Cyndi Lauper had presented Lou Albano with a gift. It was a framed gold record. And so Piper comes into the ring and grabs the gold record, and basically he smashes it over Captain Lou's head. It shatters everywhere. Lou Albano falls. The crowd is just mortified by this. He's beating up and stomping on Captain Lou. Cyndi Lauper lunges at Piper, grabs his leg to try to stop him, and Piper takes his boot and shoos her away, basically boots her out of the way. And Cyndi, I can't say she took a bump. I guess she sort of took a bump. She was on the ground the whole time. I mean, when she got down to grab Piper's leg, he essentially just pushed her away with his boot. But it looked great, and Cyndi rolled over, and people were just completely shocked by all this. And David Wolfe, who again was Cindy's manager and might have been her boyfriend at the time, goes after Piper. Piper picks him up, and it looked like he was going to give him a body slam, but I guess David Wolfe wasn't cooperating or whatever. And basically, he has Wolf up in this awkward position, walks a few steps with him, and then just fucking drives him down, spikes him into the mat, almost like a brainbuster type move. And David Wolf is out. I mean, he is selling this like death. People are going crazy. Hulk Hogan and Wendy Richter, who had left, come back out. Piper and Orton flee. The crowd is just absolutely disgusted by what they've just seen. And there you go. The feud is born. Hulk Hogan and Roddy Piper. What a fucking angle this was to watch. It really was great stuff. You might even be able to find it on YouTube. Gorilla Monsoon was by himself at that point on commentary doing the announcing, and he was selling this and, you know, how this was just completely classless on the part of Roddy Piper and this and that. And it was a great, great, great angle. And obviously, it led to a very successful WrestleMania show, which led to more WrestleMania shows, to the point that we have the 27th installment of WrestleMania coming up in just a couple of months. So if you have WWE Classics on demand, it might still be up there. They have it divided into two parts. It's in part two. But even if it's not up there, you can still find it. I would highly, highly advise you check out this angle if you haven't seen it. I've seen the clips of Roddy Piper smashing the gold record over Captain Lou's head, but I never saw the full angle before, from start to finish. This was my first time watching this, and this fucking angle was better than almost anything I've seen on WWE television all year, except maybe the old school Raw. And what does that tell you? Need I say more? So again, check out that angle if you've never seen it. It's just great stuff. I was going to do a little quick review for you, a movie review, of a movie I saw this past week. And why would I do a movie review here on The Sound Off? Well, first of all, it's my show, so I can do whatever I want. And I know I still haven't gotten to Legendary yet. I have it, I just haven't watched it, and it's not a priority of mine. But what I did see was the movie Southland Tales, which is from several years ago. It was one of the early movies that The Rock did. And he was one of a litany of different stars in this movie, but he was essentially one of the main characters in the movie. It was a Richard Kelly film that it's this very, I guess, futuristic film that is set to depict the apocalypse, I guess, the end of the world. This cast that they have for this movie is one of the more bizarre assembly of stars that I've ever seen. I wouldn't say there's any real A-list actors on this roster of stars, but there's a lot of name people in this movie. You know, The Rock, who's a bigger star now than he was then, but The Rock is in there. Sarah Michelle Gellar is in there. Mandy Moore plays The Rock's wife, even though she's not in the movie all that much. There's a whole bunch of comedy people from Saturday Night Live and Mad TV. Will Sasso, who, of course, once upon a time had a little feud going with Bret the Hitman Hart. Sherry O'Terry was in the movie, and another, I think, Amy Poehler. John Lovitz, Justin Timberlake, Sean William Scott, who's appeared in other films with The Rock as well, namely The Rundown, and a bunch of other names I'm not even remembering right now. Some character actors that perhaps you wouldn't recognize. You know, Wallace Shawn is in the movie. Wallace Shawn was the kidnapper from The Princess Bride, which had Andre the Giant in it, so there's another wrestling connection. John Larroquette is in the movie, and just a bunch of other people. And it's a 2.5-hour movie, and I had read that it was one of the worst movies ever made, which is why I had to watch this. I just had to watch this. How is it that The Rock ended up being in a movie that is considered one of the worst movies ever made? Well, first of all, it's not The Rock's fault. The Rock was actually one of the more redeeming qualities in this movie. Not that he was a great actor in this movie. He did his part, and it didn't offend me. But it's one of these movies where there's so much going on, and at the same time, it's hard to follow, and very little makes sense. They try to bring all these different stories with these different characters together, as though they overlap in some way. And they kind of do, but it's very clunky the way that it's done. It's very hard to follow. It's just way too much going on. I would never, ever call this the worst movie ever made. Would I watch it again? No. But there have been far worse movies made. G-Li, for example, with Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck. Let's see, what else? Ready to Rumble, one of the worst god-awful pieces of cinematic shit that I've ever seen. Literally. I mean, for fuck's sake, there's a fucking truck that overturns in the movie and spills shit and sewage all over the place. Wrestling, everybody. Actually, I guess in some ways that movie came to define the final dying days of WCW, full of shit. And also, David Arquette was in that movie, and he was the WCW champion, so that's also rather appropriate. So, not the worst movie ever made. It's a movie that many of you probably never even heard of. It just never, you know, it got a release, but it was never a wide release, and it was quickly shunned, I guess, after it came out, and never to be spoken of again. I've never heard The Rock talk about it. But I guess, you know, for curiosity's sake, if you want to check it out, I guess I could recommend it to check out. But it was a chore watching this movie, and I still don't understand three-quarters of what I watched. So, not sure how The Rock got tied up in that movie, but hey, when you're in a movie and you get to make out with Mandy Moore and Sarah Michelle Gellar, I guess it really isn't all that bad of a work day for The Rock. So, good for him. All right, let's get to your questions. My second mailbag in as many days here. This one comes from Mario in Egypt. Dear Solomonster, I was watching the new and improved DX DVD and noticed how the crowd reacted in such a huge way to the reunion. Thought I would ask you, what was the biggest pop ever from WWE crowds in the last 5 years or so? I thought the reunion of HBK and Triple H was it, but I want to hear your thoughts on that. Limiting it to the last 5 years kind of sucks because there haven't been very many crowd pops in the last 5 years that compare to some of the biggest pops I've ever heard, which just off the top of my head, I mean, obviously you think back to WrestleMania 18 in 2002 when Hulk Hogan was hulking up during his match with The Rock. I mean, that was just a magical reaction. And really, any of the times that Hogan first appeared on TV in Canada back then, and not even, you know, I mean, the next night on Raw after WrestleMania when Hogan came out, the reaction he got that night, the reaction he got in 2003, I believe, when he came back to TV to start his feud with Vince McMahon, and I think it might have been Canada then as well, it might have been Montreal, I don't know, but some of the pops Hogan got back in 02 and 03 were far, 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 far bigger. The pop that Steve Austin got the night that he ran out there on Raw to help Mankind win the title for the first time in 99, I know I'm going back more than 5 years, but again, pops in the last couple of years, for those of you young people out there, do not compare to pops from 10 or 15 years ago. There's just no comparison because the crowds are just very different now. Last 5 years, off the top of my head, I think back to the 2008 Royal Rumble. And maybe I'm a little bit biased because I was actually in the building that night at Madison Square Garden. That was the night that John Cena made his surprise comeback. People thought John Cena was still hurt, that he wasn't going to be there. Out comes number 30, and Cena comes out, much to everybody's surprise. I was in the building that night. Everybody was shocked. People were cheering. People were crying. People were going crazy. And of course, once the music stopped and Cena actually got in the ring and started wrestling, people realized, what the fuck are we cheering this guy for? We hate this man. And they started booing him. But before that, the pop he got was unbelievable. So I'd actually go ahead and say probably the 08 Royal Rumble. And Cena's reaction when he came back was probably bigger than anything else I can remember in the last couple of years. All right, this question comes from James. Dear Solomonster, you have so often stated that Raw has been lacking since Shawn Michaels left WWE, which I completely agree with. Who do you see in the future filling in the gap for the spot left by Shawn Michaels? I'm not implying that any one person could ever replace Shawn or that someone could ever completely fill in the gap that he left, but I'm wondering who can fill that gap adequately enough, if anybody. And in my response, I directly emailed James back, and I told him, I'm not sure that there's any one person who can fill that gap. Nobody could fill the shoes of Shawn Michaels, just like nobody can fill the shoes of Ric Flair or Steve Austin. It's unfair to those people. It's unfair that people compare Steve Austin and Randy Orton and keep calling Randy Orton, for example, the next Stone Cold. Randy Orton is not going to be the next Stone Cold, not in the PG era anyway. Let Randy Orton be the first Randy Orton and not the next Steve Austin. But anyway, I think that spot is, instead of being filled by one person, it'll probably be filled by a couple of different young guys. You know, I figure guys like Sheamus, John Morrison, The Miz, and Daniel Bryan. But, you know, I did have a thought here. Of those four, Daniel Bryan may actually come closest to filling that gap. I mean, if they were to let him work his own style, you know, he's guaranteed to have great matches with virtually anyone he works with. And he plays a great babyface in peril. People get behind him. They cheer for him. They seem to like him. They keep chanting his name. He's somebody that people can get behind. And it really shouldn't come as any surprise that Daniel Bryan happened to be trained in part by Shawn Michaels. So perhaps if there's any one person, it could be Daniel Bryan, but I think it'll be a collection of people and not just one. All right, we got a message here from Scott, a longtime listener since about episode 65 or so. Solid Monster, you mention it often, and as a WWF fan since 1988, I'm also painfully aware that wrestling stipulations like retirements and loser leaves towns rarely last and are almost always reversed at some point. With that being said, I always wondered what they had planned for the Macho Man career-ending angle from 1991. It was a big enough mark back then to believe that Savage's wrestling career was over after WrestleMania 7, and I thought putting him into the broadcast booth was a nice way to keep him on TV and solidify the fact that his days as a wrestler were over. Was this just a case of Savage being hurt and needing some time to heal, and WWF not wanting him off TV? It almost seems like Macho Man was basically inserted into the spot vacated by the Warrior when he abruptly left, or was fired at the end of SummerSlam 91, and then vacated by Sid, who ended up injured. Well, that is correct, actually. Warrior was supposed to feud with Jake and then got fired over a money dispute. That was the night at SummerSlam that he wrestled, and then Vince fired him backstage. Sid, who had just come into WWF as a babyface and was actually a referee for the main event of SummerSlam that year, he was supposed to be feuding with Jake Roberts, and then he tore his bicep, I believe, and came back at the Royal Rumble. But let me just get to the end of the letter here. He says, I never understood why they wouldn't have pushed a Warrior Macho King WrestleMania main event for the WWF Championship. I'm guessing Hogan played a role in that. I have a ton of questions about that time frame and would love to have your perspective on that. Well, just to start backwards and answer the end of your email first, the plan all along, they wanted Hogan and Slaughter. They wanted to play off the Iraq War and the whole Desert Storm angle. That was the plan. Warrior was not hacking it as champion. Business did not boom the way they thought it would with him as champion, and they wanted to get the belt off of him. I think a Hogan-Warrior rematch would have been a better choice. But, again, what we ended up getting with Savage and Warrior was one of the best matches the Ultimate Warrior has had ever in his career. And even more so, what we got out of it was one of the all-time great, all-time emotional wrestling angles with Savage and Elizabeth at the end of that match. You know, I'm man enough to say that every time I watch that friggin' angle at WrestleMania 7, it even gets to me. I mean, for crying out loud. All these years later, it's just so well done. You know, and again, it's back at a time when Savage and Elizabeth were together for so many years. Everyone thought of Macho Man and Elizabeth together. And then when they broke up and Savage turned heel, the two of them were apart. You know, Elizabeth was on TV for a little while longer, and then she was off TV completely. And Savage was a heel for a couple of years before they finally reunited. So when they reunited, it just meant so much more. And these days, wrestling, you know, it's just completely different with weekly TV and pay-per-views every 2 weeks. You know, people break up or people are together and then they'll break up. And then if they do a reunion, it's like 2 months later. So it was just very well done. Now, to go back to the beginning of your question here, I mean, the basic answer is, as I remember it, and I remember reading about this, and I don't remember where, but it's been in more than one place, because I was wondering the same thing years ago. I didn't even know the answer to that question, and I looked into it. The belief on WWF's part was that Savage was going to be off for a couple of months and come back. It was never meant to truly be the end of Macho Man's career. I believe what happened was Savage and Elizabeth were going to start a family together. I think they were going to have kids. And for whatever reason, that did not happen. Now, again, my guess, I'm not going to say that this is fact. My guess would be the reason that he wanted to take time off was because he was going to get off the gas, as many wrestlers were around that time period. And he knew that by getting off the gas, which was recommended if you were going to start a family, because you didn't want there to be problems with the child, you would get off whatever you were on, and it would take a while for it to get out of your system, and then you can try conceiving a child. I believe that was the situation with Savage, and he wanted to take some time off and try to make that happen. And to keep him relevant and to keep him on TV, that's why they put him at the announce booth. And again, at first he was more of a heel announcer, and then over time he became more of a babyface almost. Although really, it was kind of funny if you think about it, because the angle at WrestleMania turned him it turned him babyface, but he still was acting very heelish on commentary the first few months when he was doing it. But that's the story there. It was never meant to be the end of Savage's wrestling career. You know, in fact, just to give you a little more perspective, if you want to fast forward to 1994, which is the year when Savage left the World Wrestling Federation and signed with WCW, the reason that happened was that Savage was very unhappy with the fact that Vince McMahon was phasing him out, and for the younger generation, the new generation, if you remember. And Savage knew that he had more left in the tank, and I don't know that it was so much he felt he should be the top guy, but he wanted to be a main event guy. He wanted to wrestle more. He didn't just want to do the announcing. He may not have wanted to do the announcing at all anymore. And Vince just did not look at Savage as a guy that had much left to offer. He looked at Savage as an old guy, like he looked at Hogan that way, as a guy on the wane, and he had to put all of his eggs in a young basket and go in that direction. And Savage didn't like that. And that's really why Savage left WWF, and I guess Vince felt very slighted when he signed with WCW. Because remember, Savage was not just a wrestler and an announcer. Savage, I don't think he was booking, but if he wasn't booking, Savage was about as close as a person could be with Vince McMahon and Pat Patterson at that time. And there's even video on YouTube if you look for it. One night after a show, you see Vince, Savage, and Pat Patterson walking into a Denny's together. You know, which again makes me think this whole thing with Savage and Vince, nobody knows what the beef is between the two of them, but perhaps Vince to this day still feels betrayed to a ridiculous level by Savage going to WCW when perhaps he said he wouldn't, because Savage was deeply ingrained into the World Wrestling Federation culture. And he hung around McMahon a lot. They were very good friends. Savage moved to Connecticut at one point to be closer to the offices. So anyway, that was the deal with Savage, you know, back in the 90s in the WWF. Steve writes into the Sound Off. Dear Solomonster, listening to last week's show here at work, I'm at the point where you're discussing CM Punk and possibly coming back at the Royal Rumble. I thought to myself, what an interesting thing it would be to have Punk on commentary for the Rumble. And when they get to number 30, he stands up and jumps in. Not a huge swerve or anything, but I don't recall an instance where someone entered the Rumble from the announce table. What are your thoughts? Well, it's happened before. It happened in 1997, in fact. That was the Royal Rumble at the Alamo Dome in San Antonio. And he wasn't number 30, but in the middle of the Rumble, they counted down, the buzzer went off, and Jerry the King Lawler stood up from the announce booth, took off his headset. He told Vince McMahon, watch this. And he took off his headset, went into the ring, and was almost immediately knocked out of the ring and eliminated by Bret Hart. And what made this so funny was, as soon as he gets knocked over the top rope and eliminated, he just walks back over to the announce table and puts the headphones right back on. The whole thing took maybe 30 seconds, if that. It was very comical. So there is a precedent set for that happening. And you know what? That's actually not a bad idea. If Punk is cleared to return in time for the Rumble, unless they have a feud planned, and if he can come back a couple of weeks before, they can do an angle with him on TV. But if not, I think that's actually a pretty cool idea. He doesn't even have to be number 30. I mean, he can be number 10 or number 17. It doesn't matter. His music hits. Everyone is stunned. And he simply says, you know what, boys, it's been fun. And he takes off his headset and he re-enters active competition in the Royal Rumble. So I think that actually would be a pretty cool idea. Our buddy John in Northern Ireland writes in, "Dear Solomonster, I was watching SmackDown this week, and while the Edge-Kane feud is boring as hell, it's also kind of depressing. All Kane wants is his father back, and Edge is being an evil, unrelenting bastard about it. It got me wondering, what other times in WWE history have you ever felt sorry or sympathized with the heel?" Which is kind of funny. This is what I was talking about a little bit earlier. The only other instance I could think of, I'm sure if I really thought about it, I could think of a few, but it's from earlier this year. WrestleMania 26, the awful Bret Hart-Vince McMahon match, where Vince beats McMahon mercilessly over and over again with a steel chair to the point where it got very uncomfortable. You know, first of all, McMahon is outnumbered by the entire Hart family. He's having the shit beaten out of him. He was on the receiving end of a very stiff heart attack from the Hart dynasty earlier in the match. And, you know, Bret beats him with the sharpshooter at the end. But before that, Bret pummels him over and over and over again with a steel chair, just to the point that the fans weren't even really reacting to it. And I might have even talked about this on the podcast at the time when I reviewed it, but you felt, if you didn't feel sorry for Vince McMahon, you almost did. I mean, here's this 64, 65-year-old man being pummeled with a steel chair, helpless, laying in the middle of the ring. It's like, enough already. You actually felt sorry for Mr. McMahon, which was not, I don't think, the intended result of that match. So, you know, that's a relatively recent example that I can think of. Dear Solomonster, Sean here. Just wondering what you think of Lay Cool's act these days. I think it's fucking insufferable. This is a first. I got another question here from a completely different person in the mailbag, also talking about WrestleMania 7. So this must have been some sort of WrestleMania 7 showing this week somewhere. Joey writes in regarding WrestleMania 7. I've heard many people in the internet wrestling community state their dislike for this event, so I feel as if I may be the only person in the world that actually liked the show. Besides the bloated card, you had a good match with Savage and Warrior that ended up in an awesome moment when Elizabeth ran down to take up for her man and turn Savage babyface. In the main event, you had Hogan versus Slaughter, even though it may have been tacky to play off the real-life conflicts in the Gulf War. Slaughter had mega heat going into this, enough to cause the event to get moved from its original venue. Of course, it only made sense for the American hero Hulk Hogan to reign victorious and bring the belt home. I still get goosebumps to this day when I watch this match. Maybe I'm the only one, though. What are your thoughts on Slaughter vs. Hogan and the event as a whole? Well, you had me there until you were talking about Hogan and Slaughter. WrestleMania 7 is actually one of my favorite WrestleManias. It's not my favorite. It might not even be in the top three. It's not actually in the top three. It might not even be top five. But WrestleMania 7 is a show that I liked. It was not a great WrestleMania, and in fact, it almost didn't even feel like a WrestleMania. You know, you had, the year before, 60-plus thousand people packed into the Sky Dome in Toronto, and you had a main event that felt larger than life. It felt fresh, like something we had never seen before, in the babyface Hulk Hogan against the babyface Ultimate Warrior in a champion versus champion title-for-title match. And WrestleMania 7 was supposed to emanate from the L.A. Memorial Coliseum. They were hoping to pack up to 100,000 people in that building, in that arena. And I do take conflict with one thing you said here. You kind of bought into the story that the event got moved because of the heat that Sergeant Slaughter, or the company, was getting from the angle. And there was, you know, WWE claimed that a bomb threat had been called in, and therefore, due to safety concerns, they had moved the event to the smaller Los Angeles Sports Arena, which fit about 20,000 people. That story is bullshit. There was no bomb threat. They did not move the event due to security concerns. They moved the event because they knew they weren't going to come close to selling as many tickets as they thought they would. Ticket sales were very slow, and so they had no choice but to move the event to the smaller building, because having 20,000 people in the 20,000-seat sports arena is perfectly acceptable, but having 20,000 people in the 100,000-seat stadium would not look very good on TV. So that's the reason they moved WrestleMania. So let's just clear that up first. But like I said, I actually, from top to bottom, thought it was a pretty good show, really because of the Savage Warrior stuff. And for some reason, I actually liked the tag team title match where the Nasty Boys won the belts from the Hart Foundation. They had a comical skit during the show, which actually involved Vince McMahon and George Steinbrenner and one other person debating the merits of instant replay in sports, which was kind of amusing. It was a bloated card. There were a lot of matches that really didn't mean much. You know, but you had a pretty good match that started the show, the Rockers against the Barbarian and Haku. And, you know, there was enough stuff on this show. Mr. Perfect and the Big Boss Man had a decent Intercontinental title match. Andre came out. That was actually the final WrestleMania appearance by Andre the Giant before his death 2 years later. You know, I talked about Savage Warrior. It was great. The end was great. It was perfect. I would not change a thing about it. Hogan and Slaughter, I didn't like. And the reason I didn't like it was I could not credibly buy Sergeant Slaughter as the World Wrestling Federation champion. You know, Sergeant Slaughter was a popular personality in different wrestling territories, and, you know, and that's all well and good. But Slaughter, to me, at least at that point in WWF, was not a world championship personality. You know, he was a decent worker, even a good worker, but not a world champion. And the only reason they put the belt on him, he was basically a transitional champion. He was actually the definition of a transitional champion. You know, just like the Iron Sheik was meant to be the conduit by which they transferred the belt from Bob Backlund to Hulk Hogan, because you weren't going to have the babyface Bob Backlund lose to the babyface Hulk Hogan. So the Iron Sheik got about a month or so as champion, and then Hulkamania was born. In this case, Ultimate Warrior was bombing his champion. They wanted the belt off of him. So Slaughter won the belt at the Royal Rumble, and 2 months later, he dropped it to Hogan at WrestleMania because they didn't want to do Hogan versus Warrior for whatever reason. I guess they just felt they can get two different matches out of it. They wanted to milk the Iraq War angle and get Hogan Slaughter and the big us versus them, Americans versus Iraqis main event, and they can get a second match, which was actually the better match, the much better match, between Warrior and Savage. Slaughter, you know, was good at taking bumps and stuff. In fact, his big signature bump was being launched into the corner at a very high rate of speed, hitting the post and propelling himself over the top into the floor. I think he did that in this match. I don't remember. I know he did it in the 92 Royal Rumble. Sid just fucking launched him across the ring. But Slaughter didn't do much for me. And this story was so played out. And what was funny about it was the Iraq War was over at that point. And they went through with this angle anyway. They were determined to try to make money off this angle, even though the war was over. It was done. There was no conflict anymore. It was already old news. But they wanted to play this angle out to its completion. To me, there was no drama because Stevie fucking Wonder could see who was winning this match. I mean, was there really anybody in the fucking universe that thought Sergeant Slaughter was going to keep the title that night? Was there a single person over the age of 3 who really thought Slaughter was going to retain the title? There was no drama there. There was no question that Hogan was walking out with the belt. And again, at that point, some people were already starting to get tired of the act. So, you know, you're a fan of the Hogan-Slaughter match. It gives you goosebumps. I get my goosebumps from the Warrior-Savage stuff and from the Savage-Elizabeth stuff. So I guess the two of us can enjoy our goosebumps for different reasons. Because I didn't get goosebumps from that main event. I got stomach cramps. So that came from Joe Dubb in Louisville. All right, a couple more here. This comes from Vince, hopefully not McMahon. Dear Solomonster, been a fan since 125. Just wondering, what are your thoughts on Jeff Hardy's situation and whether or not he will go to jail? And what do you think TNA will do about it, if anything? Well, knowing TNA, they'll probably give him the TV title as well as the world title. John from Chicago. Dear Solomonster, I have some questions about Goldberg. First, what was the deal with Lesnar versus Goldberg at WrestleMania 20? Fans obviously knew the match would be the final one for each performer, so there was a ton of heat. However, the match was awful, with Lesnar and Goldberg standing around for much of the match. What was the story behind it? Were they surprised at the extremely negative reaction, or did they plan to not do anything during the bout? Well, I can tell you that they did not plan to do nothing. They wanted to go out there and steal the show, and in some ways they did steal the show, but for all the wrong reasons. They were completely taken out of their element by the reaction from the crowd. They did not expect that sort of rabid reaction, that rabid negative reaction and the chants. They were really, really shaken by it. And you can tell that it affected their psyche because they had a shitty match. And that was not their intent, to go out there in their final night with the company and have a shitty match at WrestleMania at Madison Square Garden. I can tell you that that was not their intent. It was absolutely the crowd. And some people can handle it, and some people can't when it comes to the MSG crowds. And on this particular night, Lesnar and Goldberg, well, they just couldn't handle it. Also, if Goldberg were to come back for WrestleMania, who would you put him up against? I wouldn't want him to go against The Undertaker, but facing off against Edge would be intriguing. I believe I read on SC Scoops that Goldberg once criticized Edge's spear, calling it weak. I think a battle of the spears could work. What about you? Well, Goldberg went on his Twitter. I think he was asked about it, and he did call Edge's spear weak. I don't know that I would make that the basis for a WrestleMania feud, a Twitter post, but... yeah, why not? I mean, it doesn't. Right now, negotiations between WWE and Bill Goldberg are cold, from what I understand. So there's nothing happening on that front right now, but there's still time. You know, again, they're looking for that one big idea for WrestleMania, and it ain't going to be Brock Lesnar. You know, Dana White of UFC made that very clear. He's not going to allow Lesnar to do work for WWE as long as he's under contract, because he doesn't want to blur the lines of real and fake. And I can totally understand that. Edge, where does Edge go after this feud with Kane if he doesn't win the title, which I presume he is not? Well, I don't know. Edge doesn't have much else to do right now unless you put him in a feud with Alberto Del Rio. I could see maybe that working. But Edge and Goldberg at WrestleMania, why not? Why not make it a battle of the spears? James emailed, not a question, but an awesome quote, apparently, that Michael Cole made on SmackDown this week when he said, "You don't get many championship opportunities here in WWE." Thought that was funny. Edsel from Long Beach, California writes in, "I can't sleep, so I'll email you, Solomonster, at 3:16 a.m. in the morning, Pacific time. I hope just because of this I get on the podcast this week." Well, there you go, Edsel, you're on the show. Anyway, he says, "I don't know if you answered this before, but my question is this. With a lot of the veteran wrestlers retiring pretty soon or already retired, who do you think would make a good color commentator or play-by-play personality after they hang up the boots?" Well, let's see here. CM Punk has certainly shown the aptitude for it, although, again, Punk is going to be back wrestling as soon as he heals up from his injury. But when he's ready to hang up the boots, CM Punk would be a great commentator. I think he's established that in just the first couple of weeks on Raw. I think somebody like a William Regal, Big Show, who you know, even recently on SmackDown, Big Show was on commentary. And Big Show is a very, very witty guy. In fact, there were two different times this year when Big Show impressed me on commentary. Once was when he was on commentary, I believe, with Chris Jericho. This would have been when Jericho were the tag team champions. That was on Raw. And he did a hell of a job. And then more recently on SmackDown, he was on commentary. And again, he did a very good job. So I don't know that Big Show, when he retires at his size, is going to want to keep traveling just to sit and have Vince McMahon yell in his ear. But... You know, JBL did it, and then he didn't want to do it anymore. Mick Foley did it, and then he didn't want to do it anymore. And Taz did it for a long time, and he didn't want to do it anymore. But Big Show, I think, would have great aptitude for it. He's a very witty, very funny guy. He's a very articulate and very well-spoken. You know, a guy like a William Regal, I think, could do it. Could The Miz do it? Sure. You know, Edsel went on in his letter to ask about The Miz. The Miz could do it, but The Miz is not going to. The Miz is very young. He's the world champion, and he's many, many years off from doing it. You know, who's to say how he'll sound and how he'll be when he's 35, but could The Miz do a good job on commentary? Of course. The Miz has the gift of gab. He knows what to say and when to say it. And, you know, how people are going to react to the pressures that are put on them, nobody knows. Miz can be great on the microphone, but if you put a headset on him and he's being told what to do and what to say and is being yelled at, it affects different people in different ways. But sure, Miz would be great. Punk is great. Big Show would be good. Regal, I think, would be good. Maybe even somebody like a Goldust. Again, Goldust's in-ring days, who knows? Are they over? I hope not. But would Goldust make a good announcer? He could, as long as he drops the, or I guess he did drop it, but I was going to say, as long as he doesn't bring back the old Tourette's storyline where he starts freaking out every time he talks, I think he would make a good announcer. All right, let's do two more here. Tony writes in, "Dear Solomonster, seeing Vince McMahon and Eric Bischoff shake hands and hug on Raw back in 2002 was a moment that I never thought I would see. After his tenure with TNA is over, do you see Eric Bischoff in the WWE Hall of Fame? Even though I think he's not what TNA needs." Do you see Bischoff back in WWE taking an on-air or behind-the-scenes role? The reason I ask is because when the GM of Raw was Bischoff back in the day, I thought he played the role perfectly. And he'll have Vince McMahon to, quote-unquote, control him. First and foremost, absolutely not do I see Eric Bischoff taking either an on-air or behind-the-scenes role in WWE. That ship has sailed. However, I would actually be very surprised if Eric Bischoff did not get into the WWE Hall of Fame. It's going to be many more years before it happens, but I predict that Eric Bischoff will absolutely get into the Hall of Fame, or at the very least, he'll be offered an induction at some point. And I say that because, again, WWE has opened their doors in this imaginary Hall of Fame that exists only in the mind of Vince McMahon. They have opened their doors to personalities from outside World Wrestling Entertainment. They put Vern Gagne of the AWA, who was at war with Vince McMahon once upon a time and had not so nice things to say about him. They put Vern Gagne in their Hall of Fame. There's certain other individuals that really didn't compete at all, and or at the very least, they didn't really make much of a name for themselves in WWE, but they did in other promotions, and they too are in the Hall of Fame. So if that's the case, and it's not relegated to just one's WWE accomplishments, then I think Eric Bischoff's resume speaks for itself. Eric Bischoff, more often than not, is full of shit. I think Eric Bischoff does get a lot more credit for being a lot smarter when it comes to wrestling than he really is. He can crow and talk about the NWO all he wants to, but Bischoff, I think, maybe at one point had even acknowledged this himself, that he stole the idea from Japan, and that's fine. Wrestling is based on people stealing shit from other people. And you know what? I have no problem with that, as long as the shit that you're stealing is good and makes sense. But again, if you want to give credit to Bischoff, oh, he's such a genius, well, at least he came up with the NWO angle. Well, you know what? He didn't really come up with the NWO angle. So if that's really all you have to go on, Bischoff's body of work does not really impress me that much. Yes, he is the one who went to Ted Turner and got Turner to give him 2 hours of primetime TV on Monday nights. And he is the one that, even though he didn't create the actual angle itself, he did, you know, turn the NWO thing into a WCW storyline after taking it from New Japan Pro Wrestling, and he made it work. It was a huge success. Beyond that, name me one real success of Eric Bischoff. Bill Goldberg? Maybe. But Bischoff didn't create Goldberg. Goldberg, it just happened. Goldberg went out there a couple of times, and people started cheering for him. So they ran with it. The fans dictated that. It wasn't like Bischoff said, "Wow, this guy has something, and I think we're gonna go all the way with this Bill Goldberg fellow, and we're gonna give him an undefeated streak and make him world champion at some point." Didn't work like that. Bischoff and TNA has been an utter failure. Bischoff in the dying days of WCW did nothing to help that promotion, and quite frankly, Eric Bischoff was the executive producer of WCW going back to the early 90s. He was with that company a long-ass time before the Monday Night War started. And there was... Go back and watch some of the stuff from WCW, for example, in 1993. Go back and find the skit with Cheatham the Midget on YouTube, okay? Shit like that is also the brainchild of Eric Bischoff. And again, you could say the same thing about Vince McMahon. For all the great stuff that Vince McMahon has done, and in many ways he is a genius, but again, Vince is not the genius that some people make him out to be. There's been a lot of bullshit that has been produced by Vince McMahon over the years. Having said all of that, and I know it sounds like I'm making a case for Bischoff not to go into the Hall of Fame, but I'm doing the opposite here. Bischoff, nonetheless, has had a lot of success in the wrestling business. He was at the forefront of a wrestling company that was beating WWF for a couple of years, and then the wheels came off the wagon. But you're absolutely right. As a GM in WWE, as an on-air character, Bischoff perhaps was the best Raw GM that there's ever been. He played the role to perfection. And he's a very easy guy to hate. That's why Bischoff works so much better as a heel than a babyface. They put Vern Gagne in the Hall of Fame. I think at some point you got to put Eric Bischoff and you got to put Paul Heyman in there as well. I just think it's a must. And lastly, got a quick email from Bones, who said that today is his buddy Chestnut's birthday. And I know he's tuning in this week, as always, so I'd like to send him a shout-out. Thanks, dude. You rock. So there you go. Today is Chestnut's birthday. Happy birthday, buddy. Hope you make it a good one. And really, if you're listening to the Sound Off on your birthday, I can't think of a better birthday gift to give to somebody. The gift of the Sound Off. It's the best gift of all, especially around the holiday season. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is the email address if you have a question that you would like to have read on the air or a birthday shout-out or whatever. I make no guarantees, but I will try to get them on the air, and I will try to answer you directly in some cases. So email me at that address. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Solomonster. A lot of fun stuff on there as well. Doesn't cost you a thing. And same thing with Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolomonster. Or you can do a Facebook search, and you see the Solomonster Sounds Off logo. You can friend me that way as well. Lots of good stuff on Facebook. And like I said, at some point soon, we're probably going to do another Facebook-only mailbag for one of the shows. And if you want to get your question in there, you got to be friends on Facebook to do it. So get on there. And, of course, you can also subscribe to this very show through the iTunes store. It is free. You sign up for it, and it will automatically be downloaded as soon as there is a new episode. It does not get any easier than that. Also want to give a quick shout-out here before I sign off to my good buddy Webmaster Mike for SEScoops.com. For those of you who didn't see the announcement made this past week on Facebook, SEScoops has scored an exclusive interview with Chris Jericho, very first undisputed champion. Just ask him. He'll tell you. He's got a new book coming out in February, and that is when Webmaster Mike will be conducting the phone interview with Jericho in February. So that is coming up relatively soon, and congrats to Mike on that big scoop. You get a lot of great original content like that on this website, in case you didn't notice. So that is going to do it. Until next time, and the next time Shane Helms makes a really stupid comment, which probably won't take very long. Episode 138 coming up next week of the Sound Off here on SEScoops.com. We'll be back then. Until next time, be well, stay safe. Take it easy, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.